Regular listeners, thank you for tuning in, and also a warm welcome to all newcomers, of course. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and Red Ice Radio is the name of this program. We have been doing it since 2006, and you need to go back 4 more years to get to the start of the website. Since that time, and before that, we have an interest in reality, truth, wisdom, and how we can heal from many of the ailments that seems to go along with the human condition. We have a lot of problems on this planet, and even only focusing on the problems can lead to more problems. So understanding and progressing is a key aspect if one even is remotely interested in life. We've tried to highlight different sides of the same issues in order to come to an understanding about them, and a central part of all of this is to let our guests speak their hearts, minds, and share their perspectives so that we can make up our own mind about the material. All of this is about the freedom to form our own understanding about the world we live in. If more people were thinking for themselves instead of walking in the footsteps of others, the world, I believe, would be a better place. So, what we do here on the website is that we cover a lot of different topics. I suggest you look through the archives. I'm sure you can find something interesting and of value. And sometimes, remember this, it's also very giving and stimulating to actually listen to something that we think we might not be interested in, or things that we think we don't like or agree with. It's very important to define our own beliefs and question why we have them. This way, we hopefully can expand our perspective and our understanding. Today, we have Stefan Molyneux with us from Canada. He is a blogger, essayist, and author. In 2006, he quit his previous job in the field of computer software and now works full-time on freedomainradio.com, a philosophical community website. And we are going to hear what he has to say about virtue, ethics, moral responsibility, the non-aggression principle, and how it is violated in society and by governments. Let's roll. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Stefan. It's really good to have you with us. First of all, thank you for taking the time talking with us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
You bet. This is going to be really interesting. Free Domain Radio, I've been enjoying many of your podcasts and philosophical presentations and discussions for some time now. And, you know, I like this idea of getting to the core of what things really are. A while back, I even went back to your 2006 archives and kind of listened to the early podcasts that you did in the beginning, really addressing some of the fundamentals. And I think that's something we could do a little bit here as well today. But before we, get started and get going, in a sense, at the outset, for potential newcomers to you and to your work, Stefan, why Free Domain Radio?
You mean why the title or why the show as a whole?
Why the whole website? Why the show?
Well, I believe that ethics and virtue and good behavior and right thinking are the most essential ingredients to the happiness of the world. And this is, of course, not my idea at all. This goes all the way back to Socrates, to the pre-Socratics over 2,500 years ago. But I have felt, and I've been really working in philosophy both educationally and just personally for 30-odd years, and I've really been dissatisfied with philosophy. I think philosophy, to use an ancient Greek term, sucketh. It does not do a very good job. Philosophy has still not solved the problem of ethics. Why be good? What is goodness? And in the absence of a rational argument for virtue, a sort of power vacuum is created, because everybody needs to know how to live. And if you don't have a rational philosophical answer as to how to live, it creates this vacuum in human life. And into that vacuum rush governments and gods and all sorts of false virtues. Sophists, as Socrates used to say, people who are skilled at making the worst argument appear the better. And so I've really had the goal to try and discover the roots of evil, the roots of injustice and dysfunction in society, and at the same time try to provide a rational system of ethics that are incontrovertible. And this is a great challenge. You know, as Hume famously pointed out, you can't get an ought from an is. And so how ought we to live, what should we do, has been largely left to personal preference, culture, law, God help us, and gods. God help us. And so I've really had that goal to try and figure out the roots of dysfunction and evil behavior and to provide a rational argument for incontrovertible secular ethics.
So, in a sense, in other words, what we're discussing about, we're talking about here is basically the meaning of life, right? One of the most fundamental questions that there is as human beings, as I mentioned, you know, for those who are thinking, for those who are interested, we're just trying to figure out what is it all about? What are we doing here? Where do we come from? And what's the point, right?
Yeah, and how should I live? You know, what does it mean to be courageous? What does it mean to be virtuous? What does it mean to stand for your convictions? What are convictions? Are they personal bias? Are they cultural imprinting? Are they religious texts? Are they adherence to the ever-shifting kaleidoscopic landscape of hell we call the modern legal system? Is it status? Is it? I mean, we've got so many. And at almost every moment, we have an infinity of decisions which can be made. How do we organize those decisions? How do we know what is the right thing to do? And I don't think that we know that at the moment. And that's fine. I mean, it's fine that we don't know it, but we don't know that we don't know it. And so we have to organize society. We have to organize our lives. And if we don't know what we're doing from an ethics standpoint, and I would argue that we really haven't known ever since the first Reformation, you know, 16th, 17th century, with the breakup of Christendom into myriad, frankly, warring sects of different moral and religious interpretations of the Bible, we really haven't known which way is up. And as the old saying goes, we haven't known our own asses from a hole in the ground. And so we've substituted democracy, which is a very bad substitute for ethics because it's just majority rule. And we've substituted a kind of sentimentality and a kind of dealing with the symptoms like, oh, we have poor people. Let's take some money through the power and the force of the state from some rich people and give it to some poor people. And we call that solving the problem because we lack philosophical values and we don't have any way of standing against the ever-increasing and ever-encroaching, you know, black vulture wings of power that are wrapping themselves around our neck. We don't have any line in the sand to draw. We don't have any way of standing up to that because all we really have is majority rule and the pragmatism of the moment, and that never stands against growing evil.
Absolutely. We're, you know, in a sense, this is about virtue, right? We want to try to do good things, as you mentioned, in a sense. And at the same time, these are the components, from my perspective in a way, that actually allows humanity to be manipulated, in a sense. These are the emotional strings that they pull, in a sense, to actually try to steer humanity into these, you know, either towards a certain point of view or just for easing when it comes to population control. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, we all want to be good. I mean, with the exception of the odd sociopath. I mean, we all want to be good. And it is that very desire for virtue that is used by those in charge to control and subjugate us. Because what do they define as virtue? Well, they define virtue as adherence to the ruling class. Lo and behold, you know, yep, I mean, yep. It's like the old argument in Christendom, which is, well, you want to be virtuous. That's great. Well, God says that to be virtuous, you have to obey the secular rulers. Because they are appointed there by God and everything that they say is divine. Or you have to obey the Pope or the priest or whatever. It's like, hey, aren't these the people in charge who are teaching me that it's a virtue for me to obey the people in charge? That can't be right. That can't be the way it works. It just seems entirely too self-serving. And, of course, obedience to any human being is an immorality, fundamentally. And it is really the root, I think, of all other immoralities. We have a void of ethics in the modern world, but there is also, it's sort of co-joined with this, there's a terrible fear of moral responsibility, of self-responsibility. And so because we are so used to associating virtue with self-attack, you know, like if I'm bad, I go to hell. And hell might be self-attack. It might be, you know, the Christian or other religious versions of hell. Hmm. And so we're just used to, like, if we're not good, we just get punished. We get thrown in jail. We get sent to the corner. We have to wear a dunce cap. We get drugged. We get ostracized. We get fined. We get whatever, right? All it is about punishment. And so we have this fear of virtue because virtue is also always associated with punishment. And so anyone who comes along who says, I can take the moral decision, the moral responsibility away from you, we're like, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'll call you the majority. I'll call you a priest. I'll call you the law. I'll call you a cop. I'll call you a soldier. I'll call you whatever you want. Just take this burden of moral responsibility away from me. And with that, we give away our souls, our children, and our future. I mean, that's an unholy bargain.
So what is the remedy, in your view, to some of these things? Is it to simply educate ourselves, get better information, or how do we kind of, is there certain components within mankind maybe that we maybe not need to get rid of, but we need to understand them better?
Yeah, I think education is a really tricky word. I mean, who's going to be against it? Obviously, education. But education is one of these things, like we say it or we wave it around like a magic wand. Like, oh, we just need education and things will get better. But education in what? About what? To what degree? Resulting in what behavior? Education is like, we need to gain knowledge. Well, you know, I could study the digestive tract of the tapeworm, and I've gained knowledge, but has it actually affected the world in a virtuous way? No, of course
right,
not. So
right.
I don't think it's knowledge. I think that we don't need more knowledge about virtue. And this, like, I think that everything we need to know to be virtuous, we kind of learn our first day of kindergarten, right? What are the basic rules? Don't hit, don't push, don't steal, don't scream, don't call names, don't grab, right? Don't steal and don't initiate force against your fellow ruddy-cheeked little carpet runner. And it's not a greater knowledge of ethics. It is merely actually putting into practice the ethics we already believe, right? So if I'm a guy who's, I don't know, 400 pounds, and I, you know, my entire bookshelf is lined with diet books, I think it's fair to say that buying another diet book isn't going to solve my problem. Mm. More education isn't going to solve the problem of my obesity. What I need to do is put down the donut, put down the cheesecake, put down the potato chips, whatever it is that I'm eating, or combination of things that I'm eating is bad for me. I actually need to put what I already know into action. I don't need, you know, it's like buying a gym membership doesn't make you healthy and reading another book doesn't make you wise. And so I think that all we need to do is we need to accept and recognize that there are two basic moral principles. They're two sides of the same coin. The first is the non-aggression principle. Thou shalt not initiate force against man, woman, or child. And the other is a respect for property rights, that we own ourselves, we own the effects of our actions, and whatever we create in the world, we are responsible for good or ill, material or moral. If we, and there's almost nobody will argue against those. People might rack their brains trying to come up with weird exceptions or whatever, but almost nobody would argue against those. And if we simply stop our sort of mental ferret in a triple espresso on a running wheel approach to things and just say, okay, let's just say, I mean, I think there's good philosophical arguments as to why the non-aggression principle and property rights are valid, but let's just say we accept those. What would that mean in society if we were to actually accept and practice the non-initiation of force? Well, it would mean that you can't have a government, because the government is defined as a group of individuals with the legal right and obligation to initiate force in a given geographical mm-hmm. area
yep.
through laws, through taxation, through debt, through currency monopolies, through preferential policies for all the godforsaken corporations that litter and stain and crater the human soul. And we would have to accept that. We would have to accept that spanking is wrong. Spanking is the initiation of force, spanking against children. Consenting adults, that's another matter, but against children. Intimidation, abuse, verbal abuse, of course, is incredibly destructive to children. So if we had the non-initiation of force or aggression in our lives, the human landscape would look unbelievably different. There'd be no fiat currency. There'd be no national debt. There'd be no governments. There would be spontaneously self-organizing communities that were all trying to make things as harmonious as possible and accrue the costs of evil to those who are performing it. It would be an unbelievably different landscape. That is not really a philosophical revolution. That's a revolution of integrity to what we already believe. That's a huge challenge, but I don't think that more knowledge is necessary. I think it's a matter of actually hitting the gas while we turn the steering wheel. That's all we really need to do, because we already know where to go, which is non-aggression principle, respect for property rights, the kindergarten ethics. We've just got to put the rubber on the road.
Now, if we touch upon that first one of non-aggression, there are obviously gray areas here as well. Violence, to me, is kind of, that's a sliding scale as well. We have things that might not be perceived to be violence by one part, but actually it's being perceived as such by the other. So how do we approach those kinds of problems, do you think?
Could you give me some examples?
Well, for instance, if we talk about the government, or if we go back to that idea again, that from their perspective or another person's perspective, to, for instance, force somebody to pay tax might not be a violent act, you know, from their point of view. But to me, it is. To me, it's someone who's enforcing something to me, but not from their point of view.
But philosophy, like science and mathematics, has zero respect for my point of view, or your point of view, or somebody else's point of view. Point of view automatically translates in philosophical terms into false, right? I mean, it's not my point of view that two and two make four. It's not my point of view that the moon orbits the earth and the earth orbits the sun and the sun orbits the Milky Way. That is not my point of view. People can't legitimately have a different point of view about the speed of light. One person is wrong, one person is right, or both people are wrong if people have differing opinions. Philosophy doesn't respect or recognize the point of view. Point of view is like, I like opera, you like jazz. Yeah, philosophy doesn't have much to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
But forcing people to sing opera at gunpoint, philosophy has something to say about that. And so somebody can say, well, I don't believe that the initiation of force is, the taxation is the initiation of force. Like, well, then you're incorrect. Like, I'm sorry, but you're incorrect, because if you don't pay your taxes and you haven't signed a contract, right? I mean, if I sign a contract to buy a car and then they ship me the car and then I don't pay, then of course I'm stealing the car, right? I'm initiating force again. I'm defrauding someone, and that's different. But nobody signs a contract. You know, there's no fetus at the moment that has signed a contract to enter into the world like $150,000 in debt because of the bribing democracy of the previous couple of generations. They don't sign a contract, and therefore they're not responsible. Philosophy clearly states there's no such thing as unchosen positive obligations. In other words, things you have to do rather than things you should refrain from doing. And so if somebody says, well, taxation is not theft, then they're basically saying that rape is consensual. But, well, no. Of course, it's not. The whole point of rape is that it's not consensual. The whole point of taxation is that it is not chosen and not avoidable. It is not contracted, it is not chosen, and it is not avoidable. So if somebody says, well, my perspective is that rape isn't violence, rape is consensual, you have to say, well, look, I mean, I'm sorry, but you just have to go back to the basic dictionary and figure out what these words mean, because obviously you're confused.
Very interesting. So also what comes up here in a sense is that perception, or as you mentioned, point of view is not... It's not within the construct of reality, in a sense. Is that correct?
If you're describing reality, you could be describing someone's point of view. You know, my friend Bob really likes pistachio ice cream. I mean, we assume that that's a true statement. It's not particularly philosophically important other than the true-false distinction. But when you are describing a transaction, then... And if you are extrapolating it to some sort of universal, then you have to be accurate about it. This is the scientific method, right? The scientific method doesn't really have much to say about Bob likes pistachio ice cream. But it does have something to say about the inverse square law, or the fact that gases expand when heated. Or it has things to say about that. If I say all gases expand when heated, that's a rule, that is a hypothesis, that is a theorem that I'm putting forward, which, you know, we need to test against empirical evidence and so on. And it... Science has a lot to say about that, and science will be the ultimate determinant of whether that proposition or hypothesis is true or false. If I say that, through natural selection and through random gene mutation and through survival adaptability, we end up with ever-growing and ever more complex organisms, and that's how human beings came to be from the first single-celled organisms. Well, that's testable. That's a hypothesis that can go out there. You check the fossil records. You look for any inconsistencies or incongruities with this. You're never going to be able to fill in all the gaps because, I mean, the number of fossils that are available relative to the beings that existed is completely tiny. It's like one in every billion animals left a tiny trace of itself.
Hmm.
But that's a hypothesis, and that's not open to just someone's opinion. Like, someone can say, well, I prefer that Zeus breathed life into a centaur, which then gave birth to a human being through its eyeball. The science is going to say, that may be a fun story, but it's not true.
But in a sense, then, that means that if we don't have enough information about something, that means we cannot determine if it is the truth, in a sense.
Such as?
Well, let's do the take the fossil record again. And, you know, this debate of why they turn up in certain areas of the world, let's say. They turn up on a mountain somewhere. And then you have an argumentation point. Well, that means that we had a flood 6,000 years ago. And the other point says, no, that actually means that the mountain was actually the bedrock underneath the ocean, you know,
right.
A while back. So
sure,
we can't know.
Yeah.
We can't know what the truth is.
Well, you may be able to know in time. But, I mean, I think you and I both know that the only people who argue against evolution are religious people. And what is strange and, I think, fundamentally hypocritical about the religious arguments against evolution is that they say, I've just had a debate with a guy, oh, there's irreducible complexity, or there's this tiny little discrepancy, or that hasn't, there's the God of the gaps here hasn't been filled in. In other words, they have this unbelievably high standard of proof for evolution. And they're looking for any conceivable, possible flaw, problem, contradiction, something that they can use to bring down the edifice of evolution. It's an incredibly high standard of proof that they have. And if they were to take even 1% of that high standard of proof and apply it to religion, they'd no longer be religious. So it's just sad, of course, to see, and obviously it's completely self-serving, and it's a desire to maintain the belief in a deity or a series of deities when there's no evidence. They're just, you know, wow, you know, the theory of evolution has to be perfect and flawless in order for me to accept it. But I will accept the Bible on faith. It's like, no. You can't have this massively high standard for evolution and say it's not proven because of this, this, and this gap, and then just turn around and accept these ancient scribblings as ultimate truth based on faith. I mean, if you have a high standard of proof, fantastic. I think that's great. Then have a high standard of proof for everything. And evolution is certainly a far more consistent and rational, infinitely more consistent and rational and proven theory relative to any form of theism or superstition.
Right. It needs to be equal across the board in that sense.
Right.
Confirmation bias. This is obviously a problem. If one's mind is already made up, we head out to try to find the evidence that supports that. How do you think that we begin to move away from that? Because this is, in some cases, even an unconscious process.
Yeah, it is. And I'm certainly prey to it. I think everyone is. You become invested in a worldview. You become invested in a philosophical approach, which you've hopefully reasoned from first principles and applied evidence to, and or tested it relative to evidence. And then when you come across information that is opposing it, it's hard. Your natural tendency is to want to push it away. And of course, that's when you should most embrace it, because, you know, we really do want to make sure. But of course, the other thing that's true is that the people who are pushing information have an agenda. People who are pushing information have an agenda. And so I think it's okay to be skeptical, even of the stuff that goes against your worldview. I mean, be skeptical of the stuff that goes with it and stuff that goes against it and so on. I think skepticism is okay, but I also think that we also have to rationally evaluate the biases that are out there and look for as wide a set of information. But again, the most fundamentally important information that we have, we already know. And so confirmation bias is really only, I think, a big problem for people who are looking to distract themselves from the basic fact that they need to put down their moral cheesecakes and pick up a piece of ethical broccoli, right, to become healthier. Confirmation bias is, you know, people who are heavily invested in sort of pro or con global warming, they get really up and bothered about this, or there's this debate that's going on at the moment about some Democratic woman critiqued Ann Romney because Ann Romney apparently was telling her husband, oh, women are really focused on economic issues and poverty and problems and this and that. And she said, well, this is basically a rich woman who's never worked a day in her life. And everyone's like, oh, but she raised 5 children. Isn't that work? And it's like, no, clearly she was talking about an economic job. Clearly she was talking about the fact that she doesn't really have much in common with women who are struggling to make ends meet. But this is the nonsense that people get involved in. It's in order to distract themselves from the basic reality that we already know everything we need to know to make the world a morally perfect place. We just don't want to do it. You know, God, give me salvation. Just not today. Just not right now. And it's like, philosophy has given me everything that I need. In fact, my first grade kindergarten teacher gave me everything I need to live a moral life. I just don't want to. So I'm going to distract myself with every bit of nonsense and trivia under the sun.
Do you think most people really know this, though? Do they have these processes within them? Do everybody have them?
I guarantee you that people know this. I guarantee you that people know this, and you can see this. I mean, I'm a stay-at-home dad, and I'm around a lot of other parents. You know, one parent's kid grabs another parent's toy. What does the parent say? Do they say, good, Now, get his daddy's wallet and we'll call ourselves the IRS. No, they say that's wrong. You don't grab. Some kid pushes another kid, which is very rare. The parents at home, they're appalled. Oh, my goodness, don't. You can't do that or whatever, right? And so, yeah, I mean, everybody knows this all the time. And the reason we know they know it is the government can't call what it does what it does, right? Government can't say, please pay your theft bill. They have to invent a new word for it, right? They don't talk about mass murder. They talk about war, and they generally mean defensive war.
Mm-hmm.
We were provoked. We are only retaliating and blah, blah. Everybody says that. So the fact that leaders cannot call what they're doing by its true and proper name, they have to invent this alternate language, right? This is like they don't say you have to obey our opinions or we'll shoot you. They say obedience to law is a virtue. They don't say we would really like to use your children as collateral and sell them off to foreign bankers because we want to bribe our friends in the here and now to get elected. No, they say we have a duty to care for the old and the sick and the poor, and that's what your contributions are achieving through taxation. So the fact that we have to invent this alternate language is because everybody knows that if you call the thing by its proper name, it would end, right? You can't ever fundamentally fight evil, because the moment that people understand it's evil, they'll stop doing it. All that you can do is fight obfuscation and misdirection and sophistry and all of the slimy, greased, oily lies that the slippery genius of language can attain and achieve. All you have to do is continue to throw the light on all of the false definitions that are put forward. You know, if you're in the swimming and you grab an octopus, the first thing he does is squirt out all of this ink to hide itself so that it can get away. I mean, that's what culture, that's what governments, that's what false teachings do. They just squirt out a bunch of false definitions and confuse and to baffle anyone. But no, everybody knows what they need to do, and you see this every day in the playground.
So that doesn't necessarily mean that language in itself is a problem. It's actually just how we are, how we don't cut through the language in a sense and actually look at it for what really is being said. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, Gertrude Stein many years ago, of course, a famous a writer herself and a great discoverer and nurturer of talent. She basically, and this was quite famous for a while in the 30s and 40s, she wrote a very short poem called A Rose is a Rose is a Rose. And that sounds ridiculous. It sounds stupid, but it actually makes a lot of sense. Because, you know, people were saying, you know, a rose is like a red flower of desire that hangs from the sky and nettings of fire from a bulbous sunset that looks like a clown's nose on fire. You know, that they would say a rose is like this, a rose is analogous, and language was getting so complicated. And so she basically said, look, let's get back to the basic language. And Ernest Hemingway was involved and invested in this as well. Let's just get back to the basic language. If we can, you know, the beginning of wisdom, as somebody wrote, is to call things by their proper names and to not live in the Platonic world of words, but to live in the world of reality and have words be imperfectly derived from reality. What we do now is we create these words and then we go and crawl up the ass of those words and live in the rectum of falsehood forever. You know, we can call it the will of the majority. We don't call it brute rule. You know, I mean, our whole lives as kids, what are we told by our parents and our teachers? Think for yourself. Don't go along with the crowd. If everybody was jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge, would you jump off it too? That the moment we become adults, it's like, obey the will of the majority. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Can you people make up your mind if you have them?
It's very interesting. If we for a moment go back to the idea of doing what is right, this drive in a sense that we have within us then, do you believe that that is part of our, I don't know what to call it, genetic physical makeup, or are these social constructs that are actually taught to us on some level?
I think that morality fundamentally, and I think this is very easy to prove, but morality was invented not to make people good, but to reduce competition for bad people. So if you're a thief in the world, and you're the only thief that is in the world, you have a pretty easy time of it, because nobody locks anything up. No, and if you go and take something from someone, they'll just assume that they misplaced it or lent it to someone and forgot about it or whatever. So if you can convince everyone in the world to not be a thief, if you want to be a thief, that's the very best thing that you can do. And this is how ethics need to be understood and approached, that they are a form of control that is designed to reduce competition for evil people. And so we are taught that violence is bad. And yet the rulers use violence to get what they want all the time. Violence, debt, enslavement, selling off the young, they do every form of horrible iniquity that can be imagined, all the while teaching us that these very iniquities are bad. Well, why did they do that? They do that so that we don't compete with them in iniquity, so that they can be the most powerful and largest thieves, so that they can be the most powerful and largest counterfeiters, so that they can be the largest and most powerful murderers. They convince us that all of these things are wrong. And that is, I mean, that goes way back in time. Martin Luther argued for this in the 16th century. I mean, it was, you know, where he basically said, well, how do you resolve an eye for an eye versus turn the other cheek? Well, turn the other cheek is you to your rulers. An eye for an eye is the ruler to you.
Yeah,
ethics were invented not to make people good, but to allow evil people free reign and reduce competition from other people. If you're a warlord and you can convince other people that being a warlord is bad, then you've got a monopoly of being a warlord. And it's a lot easier to be a warlord if no one's competing with you. So this is the basis of things called patriotism. Worship your ruler. Well, the ruler only became the ruler by killing off the last ruler. So he sure as hell isn't living by worship your ruler. You're supposed to live by that. He's never supposed to live by that. So if we understand that, then we understand that to question or to – not to question, sorry, let me rephrase that. To understand and to point out the unbelievable hypocrisy called morality in society, that a child stealing another child's toy is unequivocally wrong, but a ruler stealing from the population through debt and taxation and fiat and inflation is virtuous – is to have infinitely higher moral standards about the unbelievably inconsequential actions of a three-year-old. Those we have incredibly high moral standards for. The three-year-old with a toy. Absolutely wrong. You know, that the George Bush invading Iraq and Afghanistan is defending the country. Right. So we have infinitely higher moral standards for three-year-olds and their inconsequential actions, and then we completely reverse those moral standards when people start events and demotions that get more than a million people killed. And so we understand that pointing out the hypocrisy of morality in society, or to be more accurate, actually applying morality in the universal way in which it is inflicted upon us, right? So we're told that stealing is wrong. It's a universal rule. Thou shalt not steal. And then we point out that the rulers steal. That's something you can't do, because throughout history, anybody who actually tried to apply universals, the universals that we were all taught, that were the essence of the moral rules that were inflicted on us, anyone who said, oh, this is universal, okay, let's apply it universally, bam, they would just get killed or ostracized. And so we kind of swallow this stuff, and I think that the truth tellers, the philosophers, the reasoners, the people who listened deeply and reflected back accurately the universality that was claimed, they just got killed. And those of us who just kind of bit our lips and cheered or went along with the hypocrisy, well, we survived. So it is a hard thing to do. It really goes against our survival instincts in a way to say, oh, is this a universal ethic? Great, let's make it universal. Which means that everyone who ruled over me was unjust and invalid, and all our existing and current rulers are unjust and invalid. Well, since the rulers invent morality in order to keep themselves and make themselves more powerful rulers, if the extension, the rational extension of the morality they inflict gets rid of them as rulers, as a sort of moral justification, well, they're not going to be pleased at that any more than if you grab the gun from the mugger and point it back at him, he ain't pleased at that either.
It's do you think that these universal ethics are in the process of changing? We hear discussions about moral relativism, in a sense, that what is good and what is bad can and should be argued, in a sense. Do you feel that that's a good discussion to have, or is that just furtherance of this idea that you're talking about, that morals is for some and not for others?
Yeah, I mean, look, the absolute ethics, absolute universal ethics, is what is inflicted upon those with less power by those who have more power in order to keep them powerless and to keep them subjugated. I mean, if you can teach the cows to police themselves, then you don't even need to be, you don't need to build electric fences, and you get much more productivity. If you can teach the sheep to be their own sheepdogs, then you don't have to get a sheepdog. It's just cheaper to own human beings if you can get them to self-attack and attack each other. And so when you're children, you're taught about these universal ethics that you are just subject to and you will be punished for disobeying. However, when you get older and you attempt to universalize these ethics and say, well, wait a sec, if it's wrong for me to steal, how is it okay for the government to steal? If it is wrong for me to counterfeit money, how is it okay for the central bank or the Federal Reserve to counterfeit money? Wait a second, if it's wrong for me to initiate the use of force to get what I want, then why do my teachers support tax theft from my parents in order to pay their salaries? So you grow up and you start to do this, and suddenly you're told that everything is relative. Right? That's the defense to the curious and independent mind, is to suddenly, you know, you inflict all of these absolutes upon kids, and then when the kids grow up and start actually applying these absolutes the way they were taught, suddenly, whoop, everything has to become relative, and, you know, it's very primitive and immature thinking to this black and white stuff.
Right, right. So what would you argue to somebody here? I mean, we're in Sweden here. This is socialism. Well, it's wrapped in corporatism, obviously, today, of fascism in the true sense of the word. Here, obviously, the tax issue is a virtue, because this is about to helping other people. So mm-hmm. that's what is being thrown out as. So it's more difficult to maybe cut through the language of that. How would you talk to somebody who has that point of view?
I mean, you can certainly go for the what I call the against me argument. We could talk about it. I would just chip around at the edges to find if somebody's even remotely interested in thinking. And if they're not, I'm sorry, if life is short, I got to move on. There's tons of people who want to learn how to think, and if somebody doesn't want to, that's fine. But what I would do is I would say, can you just play this, let's do a little role play. So you play your typical Swedish socialist matrix dweller, a muggle, and he would say, you know, taxation is good, it helps the poor and so on. Then I would say, well, we live in a democracy, correct?
Well, we're supposed to, but yeah, the person says, oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and so the policies that the state pursues reflects the will of the majority, right?
Mm.
Is that true?
The person says yes.
Yeah, don't have to say the person says, just for the sake of it. just put on headlessness for a moment.
Got it.
Okay, so would you say that you have met a lot of people who vehemently resist the idea of helping the poor or the sick?
No.
No, the vast majority of people really, really do want to give money to help the sick and the old and the poor. That's been your experience, is that true?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So why do we need the government to enforce it? If people are going to do this anyway, isn't this like having a law compelling teenage boys to be interested in teenage girls? I mean, they're going to do it anyway, far more so than the law would ever. Because, you see, when you have the government, then you have fiat currency, you have national debts, you have the possibility of corruption, you have the possibility of mismanagement. I don't know what it is in Sweden, but certainly over here in North America, 70 to 80% of the money never even makes it to the poor. It gets swallowed up by the bureaucracy.
Same here.
Yeah, so if people want to help, since you've already admitted that the vast majority of people already want to help the poor, we actually don't need any laws. In fact, the laws are preventing money from getting to the poor by getting it all swallowed up in the bureaucracy. And also, of course, what is going to happen to the poor when the government runs out of money to pay its debts? What is going to happen then? So what do you think somebody would say to that?
Well, exactly. The argument, I think, from that person would be, well, if you took that away, then people wouldn't pay. You know, they wouldn't help each other.
Oh, so then the government's policies do not reflect the will of the majority, and we live in a dictatorship.
Well, exactly.
Well, no, but what would they say to that?
What would they say to that? Well, this is the thing. Since I don't have that logic, I don't know what the person would say at that point. Because from my point of view, I would just, like, I'm with you on this point, you know, so.
Well, I wouldn't expect somebody to, of course, immediately become a voluntarist or anything. But what I would be looking for is that moment where somebody says, huh, you know, I've never thought, I'm not saying I agree with you, but I've never really thought of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
All I'm looking for is there a little chink in the blind, foggy, propagandistic head helmet that we're all sort of fixed upon us as children? Is there a possibility of getting any sound through the ear mufflers of statist nonsense? And if somebody's like, huh, you know, I don't know the answer to that, or I'm sure there is one, but I've never thought of it that way. I don't expect everyone, of course, you don't agree usually in a fundamental change of values. But if they just start evading and prattling on the usual nonsense, because this is what people do, right? People say that the government reflects the will of the majority, and that's what gives it legitimacy. And then if you say, well, then we don't need the government because the majority is going to do it anyway, they suddenly say, well, it doesn't. And if they notice that that's a contradiction, then they've got three brain cells still rattling around, and you can grow more
with that.
You only need a little bit.
Right.
But if they're so messed up intellectually and so vacant spiritually that they just don't even notice those contradictions, then it's like, okay, you know, I will put the little plug back into the base of your brain, go back to your happy little matrix, I got to keep moving because you are beyond help.
Okay, well, that's a really interesting point, because what if that is happening on such a mass scale? I mean, we have a perception almost in some cases that the government makes the sun go up, you know, and then they provide the air. And so how do you... I mean, if a whole population in a country, almost, I would say, there's a lot of, you know, dissidents, if we can call it that, in Sweden too. But, I mean, the majority, I think, actually don't ponder these questions. So is the country lost? Is the people lost? Is there any way to go, you know, pierce through that in your view?
I think that it's a lot easier than people think. And, I mean, look at the two examples that I've used before. We just touched on very briefly, slavery and equal rights for women. You know, I mean, throughout history, people had no example of a non-slave-owning, non-slave-trading society, there was no such thing. And so for the abolitionists, and it only took them 150-odd years to make this change in human society, when everybody fully accepted not only that slavery was necessary, but that slavery was good. Slavery was like the white man's burden. We have to take these savages and teach them Jesus so they get to heaven. And so it was a positive virtue to happen to own slaves. And everybody thought, well, if we free the slaves, they're just going to, you know, wander around in little circles, fall into a ditch and die of hunger because they, you know, they're so retarded. And so that didn't take that long. It just took a lot of commitment. And it took a lot of, you know, unsung heroes who put great strain on their personal relationships by continuing to champion the truth and took grave risks with their own personal liberties and freedoms to do that. Same thing with rights for women. No, but it's different with the non-aggression principle, because with the non-aggression principle, that's how everybody lives in their own life. I mean, with almost without exception, I've never met somebody who said, I really want a job. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find some guy who runs a company I want to work at, and I'll follow his kids to school. I'm going to jump them with a burlap sack and chloroform. I'm going to put them in the back of a windowless van. I'm going to phone him and say, dude, you got to give me a job or you'll never see your children again. If I met someone like that, I'd run screaming, right? But I've never met someone like that. Everyone's like, oh, I got to try and get a job. I'll put my best foot forward. I'll wear a good suit. I'll practice my interview skills or whatever. In the same way, I've never listen to someone who said, you know, I'm really attracted to this woman, so I'm going to slip a drug in her drink and then, you know, carry her off to Mexico at a bath escape and force some shaman to marry us. That's not what people do. They ask the woman out. If the woman says no, they're like, go lick their wounds or whatever. So everybody accepts and lives and respects the non-aggression principle and respect for property rights. It's just a matter of pushing back that fog and having it actually be the universal principle that it was all damn well taught to us as.
What about the justification of the behavior? If we go back to the government again, on some level they might justify that this is for the good of all, and they think that they're doing the right thing. Now, what is that? Are they, you know, just convinced by their own delusion? Or
I would ask that person, how can you possibly know what is good for all? Human beings are very different. Help me. I mean, that's a statement of astounding intellectual arrogance to say, I know what is good for everyone. Mm. I know what is good for the poor. You know, because private charities, they have a kind of tough love. In other words, they want to help the poor. But there's a difference between a woman who, you know, let's just say a man and woman get married, they have three kids, and you know, the wife dies in some freak accident and the insurance company doesn't pay up and the dad has to take care of the kids. He's got no extended family. I mean, holy crap, sympathy, massive sympathy. I'd love to help someone like that. There's quite a bit of difference between that and some guy who goes drinking into the track and loses all of his money. Right?
Right.
And to differentiate between involuntary and voluntary poverty is pretty important. It's very important, in fact, because if you help the people who are involuntarily poor, you don't breed more poor. But if you help the people who are voluntarily poor, then you create more. And so I don't know, I don't have any answers, you understand. I don't know how best to help all the poor people in the world. I do believe that we should give them freedom. I do believe, you know, I'm talking about sort of third world situations. But I don't know if a poor guy is poor because he's practicing a vow of poverty or because he's studying to be a neurosurgeon and is willing to accept that poverty for now, or if he's saving up to start a great business, or if he's just lazy sitting in his parents' basement playing video games, or if he's, he's got a substance abuse problem or whatever. I have no idea how to help all the poor people in the world. I would like to donate to people who would make it their life's work to help those people, and charities and all would figure out the best way to help people. But we all know that there's this thing called enabling, which is that if you subsidize people's bad decisions, lo and behold, you get more bad decisions.
That's the basics right.
of economics. Whatever you tax, you decrease. Whatever you subsidize, increase. If you tax productivity, you decrease productivity. If you tax if you subsidize immorality or bad decisions, you get more of those. So if somebody were to come to me and say, government X program or government Y approach is for the good of all, I'd be like, wow, you are like the most genius, smartest, you are a human god. Because God knows everything, and a man who says, or a woman who says, I know what is best for everyone, is like, whoa. And I don't just mean like, it's best for everyone to not be strangled. I'm like, but that positive actions, I know what they should do specifically, not a thou shalt not, but a thou shalt. I mean, that person is like, whoa. You know, tell me what the stock price of Apple is going to be in 6 years. Tell me where Bigfoot is. Tell me where Jimmy Hoffa is buried. I mean, you know everything, so let's mine this knowledge.
In this world of globalism, the world's problem is now, in a way, all of our responsibility, it feels like. Do you think that that's also another level to the manipulation of the intrinsic, you know, virtue that most people have? And this is, again, shifting away from local problems. If we talk about what you mentioned before, that we have these organizations that are going to help all the world's, you know, poor people, instead of maybe me just helping the person I can see on the street immediately, in a sense
right.
that, okay, you know, I'll give you a little bit of money so you can, you know, buy yourself something to eat, for example. But do you think, so the globalist thing here, in a sense, do you think that that's detrimental to humanity, or is it something good?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. At least I think I do, and tell me if I'm wrong. You know, this old slogan of the environmentalist movement, think globally, act locally.
Right.
I think that libertarians and anarchists and voluntarists and the Wall Street protests and so on, I think, you know, with all due humility, I think that they've got it pretty much bass-ackwards. people who are in the libertarians love to talk about Federal Reserve and fiat currency and the Federalist Papers and the Constitution and, you know, all of this, and libertarians, I'm sure, in Europe are dealing with similar kinds of issues. And yet, we can't change or affect any of those things directly. You can't change or affect any of those things directly, right? So, you know, in the U.S., there's this massive tragedy that goes on where children who are put on these psychotropic medications, right, Ritalin and all these other kinds of mind, frankly, I think mind-destroying medications
Absolutely.
For what are considered to be largely, if not totally, non-existent, quote, illnesses. Well, it's terrible. I mean, it's just awful because the schools are so dysfunctional and they become so female-centric that a lot of the boys in particular are just a bored out of their gourds and restless and so on. But rather than adjust the school system, you drug the children. This is a standard Soviet model. Society's dysfunctional, we'll drug the dissidents. Like, that is so messed up, it's hard to even put words to it. But it's, you know, why does it happen? It happens because you've got huge numbers of single-parent households and other forms of dysfunctionality within the households, dysfunctional neighborhoods largely run by the government, the ghettos and so on, public housing and welfare and so on. The drug war creating this, you know, festering class of money-gorged criminal parasites. And of course, if the kid gets classified as mentally disabled, then the parents get more money. They're paid to put their kid on drugs, fundamentally, and the school gets more money. And so there's massive – and the parents don't pay because the government pays the drug company. So the drug companies push it. The schools push it. Some of the parents prefer the extra money, and it's easier for the teachers, and it absolves the adults of all responsibilities. So you get this horrible situation where it's inevitable that more and more of these kids are going to be drugged. Now, knowing that, what the hell does it do? I can't change it. You can't change it. I mean, I guess we could go on some smash our head against the wall for an eternity crusade, and maybe we would make a tiny dent in a tiny section of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not much we can do. But libertarians, I mean, I go around sometimes asking people, does spanking violate the non-aggression principle? And people look at me like I'm suddenly broken into fluent Klingon with a Scottish accent. And it's like, but that's a relief. See, we can do something about whether we spank our children. We can do something about whether we spank our children. And so it's considered to be a weird non sequitur to bring libertarian ethics into a sphere which libertarians can actually change and control. I have 100% control over whether I hit my child. And yet you could talk from here to eternity about the Federal Reserve, which no one can do a damn bit about. But the moment you start talking about not hitting your own children, which is a much more important application of the non-aggression principle than some big-ass Federal Reserve thing, people are like, whoa, whoa, what's he talking about? Why on earth would we be talking about this? Let's get back to the Federal Reserve. And it's like, no. We have these values. We damn well live by them in our own lives. And forget about shooting arrows at the moons we can never hit. Let's actually do what we can in our own lives to apply these values. But people look at you like you're weird or crazy. Like, why on earth would we be talking about the fact that there's not a substantial libertarian literature on peaceful parenting is a complete shame. And I think it's shameful for the movement because it means that we are only living the values in areas we cannot affect, and we are refusing to apply them to areas we can. And that is astounding hypocrisy.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. I think that a lot of people lose the plot in that sense, and that when they begin to focus on fairly unattainable goals, in a sense, without focusing on what they can do in their immediate, you know, their surrounding, basically. We're going to take a break in a little bit here, Stefan, but I want to ask you one more thing. How you think that the conversation, if any, is going on the level of the pharmaceutical companies, the governments and the schools, and to a certain extent even the parents then, that are putting these children on these, you know, SSRI and Ritalin drugs, what have you. I mean, are we talking about a conscious conspiracy in that sense, a plan that, yep, let's do this for the sake of both money and manipulation of the population? Or is that conversation, that level of awareness, not even in there? Is this something that just happened in a way? What do you think?
It happens as a result of statism. I mean, statism just creates these completely bizarre incentives, which are unbelievably counterproductive. I mean, I don't think that, you know, a bunch of guys got together in a smoke-filled room and plotted it all out. But, you know, lions hunt in packs. That doesn't mean that they have to do all these football plans and diagrams ahead of time. They just kind of know what to do. It is traditional in human society. And when I say human society, I mean a statist society, because this top-down hierarchical brutality has been the norm. It's been the universal, almost. It is inevitable for human society to attempt to reduce adult conflicts at the expense of the children. And children are sacrificed at all levels of culture and in all societies in order to maintain the illusion of concordance among adults. And in this situation, the decisions made in the past about the welfare state and so on has produced unbelievably destructive families and dysfunctional families. I mean, we are living in a state of acute and chronic family crisis. People don't really talk about it. I think I remember reading somewhere in Sweden again that single motherhood is really on the rise. Incredibly deleterious to children.
Yeah.
And this is the oldest agenda of all radical ideologies. And statism and the welfare state is a very radical ideology, because a radical ideology is one that uses violence to get its way, which is not philosophy, and it's not reason, and it's not evidence, it's not science, it's not math, it's not engineering. It is the state that uses violence to get its way. And the more you have a government, and the more you support the government, the more you are a terrorist, the more you are a radical who advocates the use of force. People don't see it because they just think, oh, it's passing laws or whatever. But if you look at the actual reality, that when you ask the government to do something, a gun's going to get pointed at someone, a gun's going to get pointed at many people, a gun's going to get pointed at millions of people, and a gun is even going to get pointed at the unborn in the forms of the debt to pay off whatever wank jobbery you want from the state.
That's right.
But so the government, you know, these terrible kids in schools, and terrible, I mean sort of unfortunate, they're just in an unfortunate situation. And the school can't change to accommodate them because the school is protected by the violence of forced taxation. The school is protected by the violence of monopoly unions, right? Because according to Marxist theory, there should never be government unions because unions are only necessary because of the profit motive of the capitalist. The government doesn't even have a profit motive. Should never be unions according to any kind of socialist or Marxist theory in the government. But of course, they're there because they profit people. And so you can't change the school. You can't go and undo the welfare state. And the teachers sure as hell don't want to change. The parents don't want to change. And so what are you going to do? Well, you're going to drug them. And the reason that they advocate the drugs is because pharmaceutical money companies give politicians money to get elected. And so politicians will then, this is statistically absolutely incontrovertible, whoever donates to you gets preferential legislation. They just found out that a bunch of corporations who donated to Obama have gotten, lo and behold, massive reductions in their corporate tax rates. Of course, business people aren't stupid. They don't give money for nothing. They give money as an investment. There's almost no better investment than a congressman or a congresswoman. You get up to 200 times an ROI just for giving them campaign money. And so the pharmaceutical companies want to sell drugs, and they can't sell it to the parents, because if you're going to try and say to the parents, here, you need to spend $1,000 a month on medication for your kid, they'll be like, okay, you show me the illness, and you show me how you're curing it. And, of course, they can't even show the illness, let alone how they're curing it. And so the government pays, and people don't even get that mad about the taxes, because the taxes don't go up when the government starts paying for all this medication, because they just borrow and print it. So people get hit with debt down the road or inflation, which not one person in 1,000 can translate back to any government program in particular. So it's just that, you know, when you introduce coercion as the basic way of getting things done in society, the ripple effect is just unbelievable. It reaches everywhere, and then people mistake that for society. You know, violence is not society. Violence is criminality. What we're looking at, the effects of what we look at is not culture, is not even society. It is violence that is scarring and marring the human landscape. And now we can't imagine living without the shadow of the gun and the sword and the jail hanging over us all the time. And it's become so omnipresent. It's like if you live in a cloudy sky the whole time and somebody says, look, it's cloudy. You say, no, it's not cloudy. That's just the sky. And we've lived under this force so long. People say there's violence in the system. And people say there's no violence. It's just the system.
We're in a lot of trouble, but the best thing, obviously, is to recognize the problem that we are facing, begin to talk about them, begin to share them with as many people who are willing to listen as possible, so we can, you know, begin to think about some of these things. And obviously, you do a very great, good job, as it were, over on freedomainradio.com, where people can check out a lot more of this kind of material. On your website, tons of webcasts and stuff. You have a couple of books out there as well. Go ahead and mention some of those, if you will, Stefan.
Sure. The first thing to mention is they're all free. So freedomainradio.com/free. I have books on a philosophical introduction to culture. We touched on my approach, or I think it's a very good approach. It's called Universally Preferable Behavior, A Rational Proof of Secular Ethics. I have a comedy book called A Manual for New Tax Farmers, which is a sort of comedy speech given to politicians about how to indoctrinate the masses. Got books on how to bring philosophy and peace into your relationships. I have books on agnosticism and atheism. All of it's free. I mean, it's a donation-based model, so if you enjoy and find them worththwhile, dropping a few kroner my way. Sorry,
that's right.
I guess you guys euros now, right?
No, we've stayed away from it.
Boy, I mean, you must have been some people patting themselves on the back at the moment about that, right?
Oh God,
we could be going down the sinkhole with Greece right now if we hadn't made that decision.
I remember a couple of years
ago. People can drop by. I have lots of webcasts. I do a Sunday show at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Sunday. People can call in with questions and criticisms and corrections and so on. So. It's all free. I just invite people to, you know, dig deep and eat deep on the buffet and, you know, leave a tip if you find it worthwhile.
All right. Very good. Freedomainradio.com. We have a lot more to discuss, and we are going to do so after this short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back with more.
Few more grains of
In the next hour for members, we address the idea of no government, which can manifest new ways to solve problems. We talk about waste, destruction, and the problems created by government. Stefan emphasizes the importance of changing society, beginning with our children, beginning at home with our parenting. Stefan philosophizes about truth and freedom. What is it, and how do we get it? He talks about how violence is at the center of our society. Is it too late to turn things around? At the end, we speak about empathy, aggression, and root causes versus symptoms. Go to redicecreations.com and log in if you're a member and want to hear the second hour. If you're not, consider signing up for a membership. I think you'll love it. Mind candy, learn, contemplate, food for thought. Okay, what's next? Oh yes, upcoming guests on Red Ice Radio. We have J.J. Hertak and Desiree Hertak on The Keys of Enoch. After this, Jay Widener, William Davis, Mark Weber, Louise Turi, Mary Sean Young, Kurt Lindahl, Tom Horn, Dean Clifford, Peter Halderson, and Jordan Maxwell, to name a few. Coming up next now is Hour 2 with Stefan Molyneux.